Today, in part three of our series, Stories to be Shaped By, we study the rich man and Lazarus from Luke 16. How can we know anything about heaven and hell? How do we learn to appreciate God's gifts and understand what God wants us to do for others we meet whose circumstances are much different from our own? Here's Pastor Seth.
We're doing a series from Jesus' parables, and the idea of a parable is something along this line. There were times when he taught, and it was more what we call didactic teaching, lecture style, what you'd normally think of as a sermon or a message. And for some people, that was helpful, and for other people, just like water off a duck's back. So there are other times where he tried what we call a parable, truth in story form. For those of you who are more visual learners, as we call them, somebody like me, it's easier to see truth in a picture than it is to see truth with a bunch of bullet points. But the idea is the same. Jesus trying to reach out to the hearts of people to help them see the realities of who God is and who we are in our need for God. Today we have one of the, just such an amazing parable. It's hard to believe it's just a short amount of verses as it is, maybe 12 verses. But it's going to talk about issues of heaven and hell. We're going to get little sort of glimpses, little pictures of what is hell like and what is heaven like. When I think about this, I often think about in my generation, John Lennon, who everybody probably knows, wrote the song Imagine. And I'm really struck by that song because there are always these somber moments in life where you'll find maybe hundreds of people gathering, thousands, candlelights usually, and this is the song they sing. And yet I wonder how often or how much we really know what we're singing when people sing that song. One of the verses goes, imagine there's no heaven. You can if you try. It says, imagine there's no hell. Only sky above, only above the sky. Hey, if you think about that for very long, or if you're a philosopher, this is the worldview of the materialist. It says there's really nothing out there beyond what we can see. There really is nothing guiding us. There's no redemptive story of life. There's really no purpose of life that's shaped beyond ourselves. You make up your own purpose. Now, that might sound kind of avant-garde by itself. But if you think about that for about 5 seconds, what kind of meaning is there in life if you have to make it up yourself? If there's nothing that makes sense of the tragedies and the sufferings of life, if there's no redemptive story, if there's nothing with which we can hope for with our lives beyond just this life, it doesn't sound all that appealing to me. Imagine there's no heaven. No hell below. Now, for John Lennon, he's beyond imagining this now. He knows. And he knows he was wrong. Over the years, I've heard people talk about hell. And usually there are four different types of things I hear. And I said them my first few years in college before I became a Christian as well. Sometimes what you hear about hell is, well, hell is just something concocted by religious people long ago to keep people in fear or religious bondage. Something concocted. And yet if you listen to Jesus talk about hell, who talked about it more than anybody else, it wasn't something concocted at all. It was something very, very real and something to take into shape. Well, I don't want to believe in a God that would arbitrarily throw people into hell. And if you listen to Jesus talk about hell, it's a place of fairness and justice. I've heard people say, well, I would rather go to hell and be with my spouse or my loved one than be in heaven without him. I've heard people say that. The irony of that is that from Jesus' point of view, the exact opposite is true. Hell is not going to place where people are going to be with probably anybody. in our criminal court system, we call this solitary confinement. And the reason we have solitary confinement is to keep some prisoners from killing each other. Maybe in God's mercy, he does that in hell to keep people at least from doing more destruction with each other than they would. I don't believe in a God that would send somebody to hell. I think I said that in college. And as our story is going to indicate, if people, according to Jesus, people in hell, even if they had the choice of leaving hell to go to heaven, still would not leave. Even in their misery. Why is that? We'll look at that in this particular parable. And I've had somebody say, I had a dying relative, and you can fill in daughter, son, spouse. And I prayed that God would do something for my dying relative, and God didn't answer that prayer. I don't want anything to do with a God that wouldn't be like that. And what our parable is going to expose is how deeply seated and how ingrained and how justified human nature is in its entitlement. There's things God owes me and he ought to do, and if he doesn't, there's something wrong with him. And that there are people that should know better and should relate to me in ways that would make my life easier, and why don't they? Spirit of entitlement. And all that's going to be seen in just about 12 verses in our little parable that Jesus tells. Now, when you interpret a parable, as we've said, there are a couple important things to remember. One is the context of the parable is really important. And in this particular context, he is speaking to a group of Pharisees who are sort of the religious elite of the day and who just assume that they kind of got it made. Their life is good, and God owes them all of their life and a future with them. And they couldn't be more wrong, as we'll see. And the second thing to remember about a parable is that it's not so much a list of bullet points as we think about didactic teaching or a class lecture regarding truth, but it's really more of a picture. It's the artist view of truth rather than the teacher didactic role of truth. Pictures, and in the pictures, the details are not to be taken in the same way that you would take didactic truth, all the subpoints. This over here, this kind of truth lecturing is like going hunting with a shotgun. You're just hoping that one pellet goes in the deer and you can chase the deer down, take it home for dinner. Whereas a parable is more like hunting with a rifle or with an arrow. Usually there's the arrow, the shaft of the arrow. There's one particular point in the parable. And all the little details of the parable are only like the feathers that sort of give it direction and help with movement. So as we look at pictures of heaven and hell, it would be a mistake to think of them as all the particular details that tell us, almost like an audio visual or something we could see on TV or a movie. These are more suggestive that tell us something about what we can face, what we're going to face. Now he tells this parable to the Pharisees. And when I think about this parable, it's such an intriguing thing. It's almost like he's scripted a play. And it's a three-act play. There are three characters in the play. And the first act has to do with the two central characters in the play. Act one and scene one and scene two are about introduction to the two characters in this life. Short scenes. Act two is the death of the two characters. Scene one and scene two. Very quick there. And then act three, he takes us into predominantly a picture of hell, and then in a smaller way, a little picture of heaven. And then he finishes the play by directing the finish to the audience, his Pharisees. And in essence, to us. So a three-act play, two main characters, a third character brought in. Let's look at the parable. Luke 16:19. This is Act 1, Scene 1, and he introduces the first character. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. So here we get just a little snapshot of the first character. Very wealthy man, nothing wrong with being wealthy. But as the parable will imply, this particular man's use of the wealth was very suspect. He was a rich man, he says, who was dressed in purple. Purple is usually associated with royalty. Fine linen, we would say, guy, you know, dresses or buys his clothes at Nordstrom's or Rodeo Drive, we would say. You know, dressed to the nines, this is a guy. Always everything in place and lived in luxury every day. Now, the picture I have of this guy would have been on Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And Robin Leach would have been talking about all the glories of his life and everything that's going on at his house and outside in the grounds and his investments. And all the people would just be oohing and awing over the wonder of this man. That's act one, scene one. The life of this particular rich man. Act one, scene two, has to do with the second character. Verse 20. At his gate, meaning the rich man's gate. Think of a gated community. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores, longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. Now here he introduces the second character, and it's about as stunning a contrast to the first character as you could draw. We find out that he was a beggar, always looking for food, barely able to eat, and that he had some type of crippling disease, right at the very front. At his gate was laid a beggar. Somebody had to bring Lazarus every day to the home of the rich man and put him outside of the rich man's gate so that he could beg. We do have a name. His name was Lazarus, covered with sores, and I think about the book of Job and covered from head to toe with sores. This was the kind of disease that was not just putrid to look at, but probably putrid to be around, and the smell from this. And longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table, and the imagery in the Greek is something like this. After the rich man had breakfast, lunch, or dinner, the servants came in and cleaned the table, and there was some food scraps that fell on the floor, and one of the servants came with a broom or a little whisk broom and got all the scraps that fell and into like something like a dustpan, and one of them walked outside the grounds, outside the gate, and just kind of set the dustpan down for Lazarus to eat. Longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table, even that was something. And he says, even the dogs came and licked his sores. So those are the two characters. Act 1, scene 1, the life of the rich man. Act 1, scene 2, the life of Lazarus. Now we go to Act 2, the death of each man. Well, before we do that, let's say one more thing, because we're gonna get into heaven and hell in Act 3. Let me say something about this, because sometimes people have questions about hell, like I mentioned at the beginning of this message. How can we know anything about heaven and hell? That's a philosophical question, a metaphysical question. How can we know? There's really only two ways to answer that question. I don't even know if heaven and hell exists. There's only two ways to answer that question. Well, if it does exist, how do we know what it's like? There's only two ways to answer that question. The first one is by speculation. None of us are going to be able to do any scientific experiments on this. We're not going to be able to do any research or talk to somebody who's been there. We're not going to do any investigative reporting on our own, take a film crew in. No, that's beyond our means to be able to do. And yet people feel very free to speculate, and you are free to speculate. I just don't believe in a hell that God would... Well, you're free to think that. You're free to hope that. You're free to wish that. But in the final analysis, it really doesn't matter what you wish or what you want. What matters is it real? The only other way we can know about heaven and hell, whether they exist or not, and what is there, what they're like, is the second way, is by revelation. And that is that whether God chooses to reveal the realities of heaven and hell to us, and if he does, he chooses to tell us how much he wants us to know or how little he wants us to know. Now, we do have an authority in this field, Jesus Christ. you would think that that might be worth something more than speculation. Somebody who's been there, somebody who knows about this, that's acquainted with both. And Jesus does tell us more about hell and heaven than any other writer in the Bible. But the language that he uses is not descriptive for the most part. It's more picturesque, more like in parable form. There's imagery there. And I think part of the reason is that the reality of heaven and the reality of hell are both so far beyond our human ability to understand that even if he spoke in the language that was true about each, we wouldn't get it. And so what he does is he gives us pictures of both that are meant to be suggestive or for us to extrapolate forward. And apparently that's enough for us, the information that we know about either one. All right, so let's go into Act 2, Scene 1. This is on the inside of your handout if you're following along. Act 1, Scene 1 had to do with the life of both the rich man and Lazarus. And now we go to both the death of each of the men. Act 2, Scene 1 is the death of Lazarus. Verse 22. The time came when the beggar died, and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. Now, that's all it said about his death. He died. There's no mention of a burial, no mention of a funeral, no mention of people coming to pay their respects, no mention of flowers being brought, flying in brothers and sisters from across the country to console and comfort some of the family members and friends. There is absolutely nothing that Jesus mentions about this man other than his death, at least from a human point of view. And you think, wow. I mean, it was sort of like Act 1, Scene 2. He was a nobody, at least in terms of the world thought. And it almost seems like in Act 2, Scene 1, he's a nobody even in his death. At least that's how it appears from the human level, from the visual level. But Jesus adds a little wrinkle here, two wrinkles. He says he died and angels carried him to Abraham's side. Angels. Now, apparently the guy didn't have any pallbearers. Maybe somebody from the city just came and threw his carcass in the back of a wagon and carried him off to the city dump. That would have not been uncommon for somebody like Lazarus. But there were some pallbearers there. Angels. Now, if you know anything about angels, it's not like we need a whole bunch of angels to pick up a person. One angel would have been just fine. So, you know, Angel Michael, strong and mighty, could have done it. But God sent a bunch of angels. And I think about something like this. Like, what does this mean for us? It'd be somebody like sending a limo for you. A limo. Limo says somebody's important. But God sent a fleet of limos. Angels. Like somebody's really important. Here I think about the presidential motorcade. Every time the president goes somewhere, you got a motorcade there. And the president gets in there, it's somebody important, all the vehicles to protect him. Motorcade's meant to make sure that important president gets to where he's going to talk to somebody important. Which is what the second part he mentions here, that the angels took him to Abraham's side. Now, if you have an older translation of the New Testament, yours might say Abraham's bosom, which means in close fellowship with him. He's talking closely with Abraham. It was probably the greatest Old Testament fellow in the entire Bible, and would have caught the attention of the audience, the Pharisees. Abraham, that's our guy too. Just a little side note there. To Abraham's side. Now, the Greek word for side is a Greek word called koplos, and it also means the place of honor at banquets. So think about this. God sends for a nobody, from the world's point of view, a set of limos, a presidential motorcade, and takes him to the top guy in the Old Testament to fellowship with and puts him at the head of the banquet table. That's Act 2, Scene 1. Now we go to Act 2, Scene 2, and the death of the rich man. And here's what Jesus said. The rich man also died and was buried. Now here we have the opposite from the human point of view. He says he was buried. And you can imagine a funeral. all the movers and shakers that knew the rich guy show up. The paparazzi's there. Everybody's dressed to the nines. There's flowers, condolences, words for the great rich man that he was, and what a fabulous person he was. And we're here to celebrate his life. And then everybody would finish, and they'd go off for brunch, and then go home. Had a big to do. Maybe you'd be on the news tonight. But Jesus says, died and was buried in the ground, a body, cold. The process of decay begins. Act 1, you have the life of the two men. Act 2, you have the death of the two men. Now we move to Act 3, Scene 1, and it's the rich man, and now we get a picture of him in hell. We get a small picture of hell, not the whole thing, but just a small picture with which to ponder. And mainly the purpose of the parable is less to say about hell and more to say about our human nature. So listen closely as the rich man speaks. Verse 23. In hell, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham, who's in heaven, far away with Lazarus by his side. Now, one of the stunning things in this parable is that as the rich man speaks, he doesn't come close, not even suggestive of asking to be out of his misery or his agony or his torment. Not even close. He's got other requests that are more important, but the idea of leaving is sort of suggestive of the same way that in one of the great pieces of literature, I just lost the name of the title in Done. Is it Done? Paradise Lost. Yes, Milton. At the beginning, Satan in that story finds himself chained near the lake of fire. And he's talking to Beelzebub. And you see him sort of trying to make the best of a bad situation, trying to put the best possible spin on it. You see his pride rising up within him. And he says these famous words that have echoed down all these many years. Better to reign in hell than to serve in heaven. You see something of that in our particular fellow here. Now, he says that he was in torment. He's also going to use the word the agony that I'm in. And most of what he describes here, what he is aware of, is it seems like the torment and agony he's in is physical in nature. Question is that really what's going on? Is that the essence of his torment and agony? Or does it just feel like that or seem like that? Well, yeah, you know, when believers go to heaven, we're not going to have this body. We're going to have a new body. And we're not really told what kind of body, if there will be a body for people in hell. For the most part, the main thing is the essence of who we are is spirit, is a person. It's personal, less body. The question I wonder about is what kind of torment really goes on in hell? And part of the way you can answer that question or sort of look at that question is what kind of joys are found in heaven? I think there are several things that strike me about torment in hell. The first one is regret. Having to face lost opportunity and know that you said no. You refused to respond. And now you're in that place forever. Issue of regret. Of course, you know how human nature is with regret. How often do you hear people say, I don't have any regrets. I wouldn't do anything different. And so even though there should be regret there, my sense is that even there, human pride will say, I don't have any regret about what I did. Even though they will be that the regret is inescapable. The second thing I think about is torment, is rage. Why am I here? What did I do to deserve this? You often hear people say that just in the midst of going through trials. What did I do to deserve this? Why didn't you do something, God, to help me know about this situation and do something for me? Or you see a rage towards people. How could you have not said anything to me or done anything for me? You will see all kinds of probably anger unleashed towards God and towards people. And then one of the questions I have, and it's just a question, and all we can really do, because we're not told about this, is speculate, is how does God protect people, or how is he kind to people, even in hell? And you wonder, I mentioned this at the beginning of the message, well, does he put us in isolation? To where at least we cannot harm the people we claim to love anymore. No more anger, no more bitterness, no more resentment, no more gossip, no more sarcasm, no more put-downs, no more arguments, no more drama. Maybe the only way that is going to happen is if people are in utter isolation. And here I think about just the awful sting of loneliness. Loneliness. No one to love, and no one to love me. Or I think maybe God allows us to be with each other and all that drama and to live out who we are. And think about the story of the tale of a fellow who looked into heaven and he looked into hell. And he saw it. One, in heaven, he saw people sitting around a banquet, great banquet like you'd think about Thanksgiving feast, and all the people enjoying each other's company and eating from the bounty of the table. And then over here, you saw the same picture, the banquet table, filled with Thanksgiving dinner, and all the people in hell angrily hitting each other and fighting for that food that's in the middle of the table. But each of the people around that table look like they haven't eaten in a month. Starving to death. What's the difference? In hell, the people have, in his picture, have a fork attached to their arm. That's about 3 feet long. And they can reach in and get the food, but they can't. The fork is too long to get it to their mouth. So what they're doing is fighting frantically to get food into their mouth, and it never dawns on them to take food and give it to somebody across the table. Whereas in heaven, the picture there is people who are delighted to feed one another and see it as an honor. So maybe God leaves us people in that situation. I think about the torment of emptiness, of no more meaning, no more reason to live, of being finally and utterly left to yourself. Really, how you wanted it all along. And then I think about the awful cycle of pride, which we get a chance to experience in this life. Why aren't you doing more for me, God? We blame him. We blame others. Why aren't you doing more for me? And then we kind of come back to ourselves and, well, I guess I should be taking more responsibility. I wasn't the person I should have been. I wasn't the man I should have been. And then we can only take that so much, our pride, and we go right back to God. And this cycle just goes, blaming God, blaming others, blaming me. Blaming God, blaming others, blaming me. Blaming God, blaming others, blaming me. Those are just speculations about the kind of torment, not so much physical as it is personal and relational. Verse 24. So he, the rich man, called to him, and here we have him speaking for the first time. Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue, because I am in agony in this fire. Now, there's some interesting choices here of phrasing that Jesus uses. Father Abraham, which is the exact terminology the audience would have used if they'd been in the same situation. The Pharisees talking to Abraham as if, why, of course, we deserve to have that kind of relationship with you, intimate relationship of your father, and we're sons of Abraham. A picture of the man's pride. And then of all the things he asks, he says, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue. What could he have said? He could have said, Father Abraham, I have sinned. And all of my life, I've been that way. And I have not repented at any stage, even though now I realize you and God have tried to get my attention in countless hundreds, thousands of ways, and I stubbornly refused to hear you. I wanted to live life my way, and now I see that the bankruptcy of what I did, and I am so sorry. I need to ask God's forgiveness. I'm asking for mercy. What I did was wrong. There is not an ounce of that in his voice or in his heart. All he can do is, again, think about himself. Have pity on me. And he says, and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water. What do we see here? We see that the man, even in hell, is completely unchanged. He still sees Lazarus as somebody no better than an errand boy. Somebody that's an inferior to him in his exalted, blessed position. And of course, Lazarus would want to do something like that for him, because that's just the kind of guy he is. And I would never stoop to do something like that for somebody else, but perhaps he would. Now think about that request. What he's asking is that Lazarus leave the joys and glories of heaven and all the suffering that he had back on this earth and go back to earth to get some water. And then to come to hell. But it doesn't strike the rich man at all that there's any irony or any cruelty in his request. And then this is one of the most puzzling things to me. Ask to send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water to cool my tongue. Now, you might think, well, golly, if I was the rich man, I'd be asking for more than a drop of water. I'd say, hey, you got any buckets up there? Can you get a hose? Can somebody dig a well? Why does he ask for just a drip of water? I think I have an idea, because I'm not all that different. There are very few things in life that our human pride hates more than asking anybody for help. Or asking anybody or admitting that we have some kind of need. And we don't do that unless we are at the point of just about utter desperation. And even then, we give only so much information and reveal only so much need, as if to leave the impression that after that, I got it. I'm good. Just need a little bit here, then I'm good. Now, I sort of get that, because I'm not all that different. I find myself doing the same thing. And I hate that, because it's a symbol of my pride. But I remember realizing this a number of years ago. I was a girls' soccer coach for 16 or 17 years, and most of the time it was girls, either 5 to U5 to U9, or when Christy was playing, I think went up to U12 or so. And one of the really cool things about being an ex-coach for some of these girls is seeing them play high school ball. It's really cool. You go to a high school, and you sit up there in the aluminum stands in winter. And you've got 2 45-minute halves. Now, I used to have two of these. They're called stadium chairs. They belonged to my parents. And when my mom died, I took these from her house and took them home. And over the years, when I go to a high school game to watch one of the girls that I've coached over the years, I take two of them. And I take one, and usually the other one is for the soccer mom that I've known, watching her daughter play, or the soccer dad. And I sit in one, and either the mom or dad sits in the other one. There have been times where I've been at a game, and either both the mom and the dad could not come. And every time I've sat in the middle of the stands, just as the game is starting, and asking all the people around me, hey, would anybody like, you know, dad, mom, not going to be here, anybody want to sit in the chair? Got an extra bleach? Got an extra seated stadium chair here? Not one time has anybody said, oh, thank you so much. Everybody sits there like, I'm not going to admit that I need that, or that I should have thought of that. I'm not going to admit that I don't have what it takes to sit on an aluminum, cold aluminum chair for 2 45-minute periods. I'll walk around during halftime and stretch out. I'm good. And so there have been many games where I sit in my stadium chair and I put my coffee in the second stadium chair. That's what's described here. This fellow in life is the same in hell. And what you see in hell is the same as when he lived his life here. You see his pride as the driver. He would rather sit on an aluminum bench during the dead of winter for 2 45-minute periods than admit that he has a need that somebody else could meet. Verse 25. Abraham, now the third character in the story, Father Abraham, replies, he speaks. Son, speaking to the rich man. And here the idea is, it's a term of affection. That even though this guy has been rebellious and proud and arrogant and self-centered, you still see something of the kindness of God reached out. Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things, meaning not just the blessings of being rich, but the providence of God and God's general goodness to all of mankind. All of those things are meant to lead us to repentance, to see the wonder of who God is. But I wouldn't have any of that. I don't need that. While Lazarus received bad things, meaning in not just that he had very few material things, but in a life of suffering, in a life of hardship, he is now comforted here, and you are in agony. And the word comfort there means the closest of fellowship. When you and I go through hard times and times of suffering, there is hardly anything that means more than to have somebody that comes alongside of you and listens and just hears what you have to say. We call that comfort. Somebody knows and somebody cares. And what's being pictured here is the contrast between, in heaven, rich relationship, the kind that touches something deep in the human heart, and no relationship. You are in agony. Let's jump ahead to verse 26. Besides all this, Abraham continues to speak, between us and you a great chasm has been fixed, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from here to us. And here's just another interesting wrinkle Jesus throws in here. He says that he sort of implies that there would be people in heaven that would want to go to hell. You think, well, why would anybody want to do that? Because there will be some people in heaven that will think of the misery of the people that maybe some loved ones are in hell and want to do something about it and would even do something of what's suggested by the water and the request of Lazarus. But notice the same thing is not inferred the other way. He doesn't say, and those who want to go from hell or heaven just can't. What's implied in the verse and through the whole parable, I would rather be in misery here than acknowledge a need and go there. Humble myself and go there. Now, the scene shifts. Act 3, scene 2. Quickly back from heaven and hell, back to earth. And the rich man has five brothers. Just a quick scene here. He answered, then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my father's house, for I have five brothers. Let him, meaning Lazarus again, the inferior, he should want to do my bidding, and you should let him do that. Here's a good idea. Let him warn them so that they will not also come to this place of torment, which implies if somebody had just come and warned me, I wouldn't be in this monstrous place. That's not the reason you're in hell. You spent a lifetime refusing to humble your heart, to hear the words of God, to respond to him in some kind of humility and repentance. The problem is not just a warning. I also think it's pretty interesting that somebody who's in hell would argue theology with somebody in heaven. Apparently he doesn't see any irony that, particularly arguing with Abraham. Abraham replied, they have Moses and the prophets. Listen to them. Moses and the prophets is a euphemism for the whole Old Testament. So they're going to need something more than just seeing somebody from the dead. He tells the rich man, they've got Moses and the prophets. And then he argues, verse 30, no, Father, if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent. Again, just ironic that somebody in hell would argue theology and just be as sure as they can be that Abraham's got it wrong. But they know better, and they know what ought to happen, what heaven should do, and what Lazarus should do. Our human pride on display. And then the scene shifts, Act 3, Scene 3. Suddenly, it's about the audience. And this is where he ends the parable. He said to him, meaning the rich man, and in inference to the Pharisees who were listening, if they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead. In other words, the problem is not one of evidence or a lack of evidence. The problem lies in the human heart. They will not listen. It is a determined belief to have life how they want it, and they're not going to let God or anybody else, certainly not Moses or the prophets, tell them any different. The problem is not a lack of evidence. The problem lies in the human heart. Now, I don't know if it's a coincidence. Probably not, since it's Jesus. But the name of the fellow that's the poor guy is named Lazarus. And a few months from now, from this particular point, he's going to go to a little town called Bethany where he knows three siblings, two sisters, Mary and Martha, who have a brother also named Lazarus. Coincidence? Probably not. When Jesus gets to Bethany, Martha comes up to him and says, "Oh, Master, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died. Our brother would not have died. But now he's been in the tomb for 3 days. And Jesus implies he's going to go and raise him from the dead. Martha says, "Oh, no, you don't want to do that, because if you open that tomb up, it's going to smell to high heaven." And Jesus tells her these words, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies. And whoever," let's go to the next verse, "whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this?" The final analysis, I think C.S. Lewis is right. At the end of every life, either we will say to God, "Your will be done," or he will say to human nature and human pride, "Your will be done." The choice lies with us. Let's pray together. Father, the men that watched the resurrection of Lazarus and heard about the resurrection of Lazarus in real time didn't bend their knee, didn't bow their heart, didn't humble themselves. It made them even more angry. And the scriptures tell us that from that point on, they determined to find a way to kill Jesus. A picture of the absolute hardness of the human heart and the pride that runs through all of us. Would you jar us with this story? Would you humble our heart and help us to hear what you have to say to us?